Ketzei Shir is dedicated Li'inui Nishmat Rechalei Abbas Rav Chaim Tzvi. Okay, until now we were talking about our relationship to Hashem through knowing Him, through talking about the world's Creator. I want to move on a bit more. Okay, the way through which we express who we are to Him, as opposed to knowing Him through observation or through thought, would be tefillah. One of the principles of faith is that there's benefit in praying to God and there's no benefit in praying to anyone else. Let's begin to talk about what this could mean. What benefit is there in prayer? And why is it something that Rambam said so carefully, and not to pray to anything else? So let's begin by talking about what prayer really is. Oftentimes people confuse prayer with sort of self-centered therapy, where you go to God and you say, I want this, and I want that, and give me this, and give me that. And there is something to be said for that also, because at least it shows some degree of awareness of this, that God's there, and that what you really need and want is only going to come from Him. It's not going to come from anywhere else. But it's not the essence of what prayer is. In order to understand what prayer is really about, I wanted to go a few steps backwards and talk about sacrificial offerings. Yeah, sacrificial offerings. And the reason why I'm talking about that is that prayer accompanied the sacrifices, but when the sacrifices ceased upon the destruction of the temple, it says, Neshama Parm Svateno, that we paid for the bulls, meaning the animals that we used in the sacrifices, through our lips. So there's a connection between them. People always offered sacrifices to God. This isn't a particularly Jewish thing. It isn't something that began when the Torah began. What is it that inspires people to want to give something to God? Today, a typical Western answer would be, people didn't know anything, and they were afraid because the elements are so unpredictable. They thought by offering to God or to the gods something precious to them, they would appease Him. Then everything would be wonderful. However, the fact that people weren't technologically developed doesn't necessarily mean they were idiots. So I want to point something obvious out. Suppose your washing machine broke down. Such things happen. So you fool around with it yourself for a little bit. Eventually you realize it's too big for you, too complex. You better call a repairman. So if you don't know who to call, you just moved into the area, it's a new machine, you don't have neighbors who you could call upon easily for help. So you let your fingers do the walking through the yellow pages, and you call a repairman cold. He comes to the house, works on the machine for 25 minutes, tells you that it's fixed, and charges you $75. Okay, you even got out easy. Okay, he leaves, you turn on the machine, it works for under a moment, and then you hear this funny noise, clunk, 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 and water begins to leak out from the door, and you realize it's not fixed. Something else is broken. Maybe what was broken originally is now working, but certainly it's not fixed. Okay, you call the repairman back. He denies any culpability for this. He says that there must have been something that you didn't tell him about. In any case, he agrees to come back, but not today. He's going to come back in 2 days. He works a little bit longer. He charges you $150, tells you that another piece was broken. This time you decide to wait. You tell him, wait a minute. You turn it on. It seems to be working. He leaves. And then when you go to take out the wash, you discover it didn't ring. Now, let's say you were to call him back a third time and get a similar performance, which I don't think most people would call him back a third time. But let's say you did, and it was the same story repeated. He lied to you. He obviously doesn't know what he's doing. Maybe he could juggle parts around, but there's something in the machine that doesn't work, and he's not making it better. How many of you think you would continue to call him endlessly? The reason I'm asking you this question is if you want to say that people offered sacrificial offerings to appease the gods, since they weren't idiots, if they see it doesn't work once, if they see it doesn't work twice, if they see it doesn't work three times, they're not going to do it a thousandth time. It's not going to happen. So there are only two possibilities. Either what they did brought about some sort of a result, which seems to me to be extremely unlikely, or they had something else in mind. And that's the something else is what I want to talk about. In order to understand the something else that they might have had in mind, I want to talk briefly about marriage. Okay, when any couple gets married, they want it to work. Nobody marches down the aisle saying, well, either yes or no. What's going to be? At worst, won't work. And I'll get a divorce, and I'll have one of the traumas that most psychologists would say is right there on top of the list. No one thinks like that. They think it's going to work. This is a person with whom I could build. Okay, so the first day, picture the first breakfast. Okay, the first breakfast, both of you are still on good behavior, right? Assuming the bride cooked something, she'll do it to the best of her ability. I'm sure the groom will thank her graciously and appropriately. That's how it'll be the first day. Where are they coming from? Is the bride making a beautiful breakfast because she wants to appease the groom's anger? Is he thanking her graciously because he wants to prevent her from throwing a pot at him? It's not what's happening at all. The reason is that she desperately wants him to love her. And she wants to show that she loves him. And the same is so on his side. There are all sorts of reasons why this behavior doesn't continue. But that's where people are coming from. In earlier times, when the world was less technologically developed than it is now, people had a much more vivid awareness of nature and its force, its power, its beauty, and its intricacy. They wanted to make a connection with the one who created all of this, or from their perspective, the ones who created all of this, because until Avraham taught, the world was polytheistic. So when they offered something of theirs, it was to show devotion. Could the devotion have brought about some tangible result? I tend to doubt it. But that wasn't what it was about. The idea of having a connection is what they thought could bring about some sort of a tangible result. And offering the sacrifice, certainly to sophisticated minds, was a way of creating connection. A sacrifice implies, however, that because I've given something of me to you, you have to give something of you to me. And there is something to that way of thinking, because as we know, it says, Kamayim panim el panim, one face is like the other face. What does that mean? Did you ever find yourself saying this to someone on the phone? I didn't know it was you, meaning if I only would have known it was you, then I would have been nice. But since I thought it was a complete stranger, it was my usual nasty self. Kamayim panim el panim means the way you show your face to someone is how they intuitively want to show it to you. So there is something to that. But certainly that's not the whole story, and it's certainly not what a korban is from a Jewish perspective. In fact, the Gemara tells us not to do what's called iyun tefillah. What's iyun tefillah? Iyun means investigative tefillah. Now this seems strange because those of you who pray using a Hebrew siddur are familiar with this, that one of the things that are counted in the Mishnah is something that has no limit. Okay, various acts of charity, bringing firstborn fruits. No one's going to limit how many firstborn fruits you could possibly have, depending on how big your orchards are, etc., is iyun tefillah, which people understand to mean praying with depth. So in fact, there are two kinds of Iyun Tefillah. Good Iyun Tefillah and bad Iyun Tefillah. What's bad Iyun Tefillah? That's me always on left foot first. Bad Iyun Tefillah is you think, the person who's praying thinks, that they can manipulate God. That if I do this or if I do that, if I pray at great length, if I offer an offering, if I, then surely my devotion is going to bring a parallel response from him. What's wrong with this? Okay, let's go back to our married couple. The bride puts down the beautiful breakfast and she says the words, "I hope you'll be grateful." The groom says, "Thank you," beautifully. And he says, "I hope you realize how much I appreciate you." As soon as you make what you do conditional, there's no more love. Because what happens then is what seems to be, on the outside, an act of giving, is really an act of taking. So let's go back to this couple. If what she really wants is for him to always love her, who does she care about? Does she care about him? Or does she care about her? She may be willing to pay a price to get the love she yearns for, and that price is making a nice breakfast. But she wants love, and she wants it for who? She wants it for herself. The same holds true with him. When he thanks her so graciously, if his true intent is to make her aware how nice he is, how grateful he is, so she'll like him, so he'll have somebody who's in his side of the court, and he's willing to pay his dues, but he doesn't love her, he loves himself. So if prayer disintegrates into negative Iyun Tefillah, where a person thinks that the deeper they go, the more they could get, what they've done is just taken an act of giving and turned it into an act of taking. Nothing could be further from love. Let's talk about what love is by definition, then we'll go back to prayer for a moment. People often say, what's love? It's kind of a question people throw around very easily. And if you were a live audience, I'd be hearing all of the cliches, you know. Love is giving. Or if I would have older people listening, love is never having to say you're sorry. Okay. Still older. A many splendid thing. Okay. From a Judaic perspective, what love is becoming one with another person. We identify with them so closely that your happiness and theirs is completely entwined. You are them. So I'll give you an example of what that sort of love is like. I want you to envision this. You're in Israel, where people ride the buses. And a young mother is getting on the bus with her little family. Okay, and the driver shuts the door before she can get the last child on. So the four-year-old's left out. What's going to happen next? Here's a scene you'll never see. Mother says to the four-year-old, "Sweetheart, it's been four wonderful years. I wish you all the best. You can go your way, I'll go my way," and just ride the bus while she leaves him on the curb. That's not going to happen. What's going to happen is the mother is going to give, this is Israel, remember, piercing scream, "Regalaham!" And he'll open the door. Because to her, it's as though her hand or her foot was caught in the door and left outside. That child is part of her. That's what love is about. It's not about a business deal in which I give you in order for you to give me. So the korbanot that were offered in the ancient world were lacking, not because there's something inherently wrong with the act of korban, but because there was something inherently wrong with the way they thought they could manipulate gods oftentimes. Now let's get back to what a korban should be. Okay, do you have questions on this before you go further? Anything about prayer and its nature in relationship to sacrificial offerings? Adam offered sacrifices others offered sacrifices, what were they saying? They were saying, I appreciate you because of what you've given me. This is yours, Hashem. I'm yours. And instead of the physical world blocking me from you, let it join me to you. The word korban is related to the word karov, which means near. And sometimes the physical world can make a person very far from God. The physical world is very beautiful and very absorbing, very interesting. And a person could fall in love with it and let it define everything they do. A person with some depth will relate it to its creator and let it be a means of making a relationship with him. That's what korban is about. With that in mind, I'm going to move on ahead. Let's leave the ancient world and go to the world in which the Torah was given. At that point, korbanot were called by their name, korban, which doesn't mean sacrifice. Sacrifice means giving up. Likana, lihimasleitmaser. Korban means coming close. So in every sacrificial offering, there were four steps. The first was choosing an animal that had something to do with the part of yourself that you saw in the animal. What do I mean by this? Let's talk about what makes us far from God. What makes us far from God is that we're all conflicted. We all have two identities. We have a spiritual identity and a physical identity. The physical self loves to take, to exploit, to own, to conquer. This all has to do with taking. The spiritual self loves expression, creation, giving, because the spirit isn't held down by the body. Now, it's possible that in the same day, a person's identity could belong to this part of himself in the morning, that part of himself in the evening, this part of himself at night, that part of himself later. We move continually. So the fact that our identities are split in this way, and it's coupled with the fact that we want real connection, puts us in a bit of a tizzy. On one hand, a person could say, I want God. On the other hand, they could also say, I want everything the world is, which is normal. So the way this was dealt with and is dealt with till today with other religions is to try to rise above the world, to transcend the world. I once saw a copy of National Geographic. So in this copy I saw a young man who had been meditating in a tree. His ankles were bent over a tree branch. He'd been that way for weeks. I believe it was 2 weeks. What was he doing? He was trying to master his body so he could devote his soul to God. That's not our way. A question came in. God doesn't need or have any use for our gifts, so why pretend to give him something? That's absolutely true. What we try to give God is ourselves, not because he's needy. By definition, he's not needy. But what we try to do is for ourselves to develop a relationship. And this is something, as we spoke about in previous classes, to those of you who are listening in or watching, it's something we want desperately. Let me explain to you how, just quickly, since we spoke about this once before. We all like physical pleasure. Think about your favorite food for a moment. Isn't that a nice thought? So, if you're going to have your favorite food for dinner today, that would no doubt make you happy, for as long as you eat it. A certain percentage of people in the world have noticed this. A lot of people haven't. Now, the reason why we can't hold on to the pleasure of food or any other coarse physical pleasure very long is because it's superficial. So when the body's desire for it fades, the pleasure fades. So those of us who notice that still want this, and I want to make this clear, we still want this, but we want more. So many people go on to aesthetic pleasure, dancing, singing, music, beauty, going on trips, traveling, owning beautiful things, wearing beautiful clothing, being thin. doing whatever a person has to do to feel the beautiful harmony that's part of our spiritual character being manifest in physical things. Now, beauty lasts longer than ice cream. Not just in terms of how long it takes to acquire the beautiful object or experience the beautiful experience, but it touches a deeper place. You can't compare a trip to a beautiful location in the world to eating ice cream. It touches a much deeper chord, but there's still a limitation. And the limitation is that the beautiful place or object is always outside of you. So the moment will come when you take off the beautiful clothing or when you walk out of the beautiful home that you're left with yourself. Some people notice this. Most people don't. And when they lose this, then it's gone. So taking this a step further, most people then, who've noticed that this isn't the end of the journey, move towards the pleasure of relationship. Loving, being loved, which certainly takes a lot longer and touches a deeper place. And even if the person who you love dies, you're still there with them. Leave something within you. When I ask people who they like the best and what they like about them, inevitably the answer is spiritual. Their generosity, their kindness, their loyalty, their sensitivity, even their humor, their understanding. It's never physical. What we're really looking for is spiritual connection. What we're really looking for is the face of God as it's projected through people. We're in His image. So the reason for wanting to connection is because God is needy. It's because we desperately want connection. We're designed to want connection. God is the spiritual source of all of the things that give us this feeling of connection. And this is what sacrifice is about. So a question just came in. Somebody asked, why do we slay an animal in order to connect? Why not connect without hurting something else? Which is a good question, and exactly where I'm going. Once a person finds the animal within them, the next step is selecting an appropriate animal that matches what it is that they're trying to uplift and rectify. I'll just give one example, although there are six animals that are used in sacrifice. A sheep. When you think of a sheep, what at least the image that occurs to me is a docile animal that follows. There is something within every human that wants to follow. To follow with eyes closed. Is this good or bad? The answer is it all depends on who you're following. Certainly, the herd instinct that takes people to wearing tight shoes is not very highly developed. But when you go beyond that, certainly you don't want a soldier in battle to decide, well, personally, I don't think the strategy is the one that I would have chosen. I think I'll go for something else. They have to work as a team. So the sheep is used, and I'm going to stick with the sheep, although there are other animals, as I said, to refine and uplift the part of you that could follow. Next step is you put your hands on the animal so you actually bond with it. Okay, the third step is that the animal is slaughtered just as we would slaughter an animal for eating. It's not burnt on the altar without being killed. Yes, we slay the animals, but for all of you who are not vegetarians, we do this all the time. The only difference is that in this case, we do it to change ourselves spiritually instead of to benefit physically and momentarily. So the animal is slain through shechita, which is a very humane method of killing in principle, although obviously people could corrupt anything. The knife has to be so sharp that the jugular and the windpipe are severed simultaneously without exerting pressure. The blood of the animal, which is its life force, is then taken in holy vessels. What's that about? This is to show us that the life force of the animal, which is its blood, okay, could be uplifted and holy if you put it in the right vessel. This lesson for us is that there's nothing about us that has to be rejected or destroyed inherently. Every urge we have could be uplifted and dedicated, a we put it in the right vessel. The final act in a korban is that some of the animal, in some cases the whole animal, in other cases parts of the animal, are placed on the altar and burnt, which is to symbolize to us that inevitably, if we want to move forward, there are some things we have to leave behind. I'll give you one concrete example. Desire is wonderful if it leads to marriage. But if somebody desires somebody else's wife, they have to say no. So that's what korbanot are about. It's about getting close to God, not by rejecting the animal self, but by uplifting it. And the reason why we use an animal is because we ourselves have to see the animal in terms of its source. We're trying to change ourselves. So it's not about appeasing or giving. It's about changing ourselves. And because of this, the sacrificial offerings required continual mental connection, unlike most mitzvot. What do I mean by that? Suppose you keep Shabbos, and it's Shabbos afternoon and you're taking a nap, and you're having a little trouble falling asleep, so you pick up a junk novel. A novel so bad that someday they'll make an Indian movie from it. So, within moments you're asleep. Did you have God awareness? Were you surrendering to the Creator? No, you were reading this junk novel. But as long as you didn't break Shabbos and you're aware that it's Shabbos, you're considered to have kept Shabbos that day. With sacrificial offerings, you have to be there. You have to be there, otherwise it has no value. Now let's talk about prayer. How does that connect? When the temple was destroyed, it was a reflection of this, that we were no longer able to maintain ourselves on this level. The fact that we weren't spiritually there was reflected in this immediate, that all of the ways of pretending we are were removed from us. So right now, prayer is our path. So we come before God in prayer, saying, here am I. I'm physical. I'm me. I want to make connection with you. So the morning prayer service is divided into sections to achieve that. The first section is the short brachot, which basically talk about ourselves. You've given us sight. You've created a firm earth underneath us to make us realize how much God has given us just to exist so we could feel beloved. So we realize our yearning for connection is answered by His love. The next section of the prayer service is called Pesukei Dezimra, which means songs of praise. So let's just look at one of them. One of them is Ashrei, possibly one of the best known of them. It's one of King David's Psalms. It's written in alphabetical order. Its theme is that you could find God wherever you look, in any generation, in any place, through any experience, to any person, with any person, if you search for Him. Okay. The reason why it's written in alphabetical order is to give us a picture of this, that you could find God through any force in the universe. People sometimes say, how can I pray? How can I talk to God? He's not answering. It's not true. He answers continually. Let me illustrate how. Suppose you were invited to my house for Shabbos dinner. And you sit by the table. I took you in the house. You're sitting by the table. You heard Kiddush. And we're up to the first course. And my daughter, who's very nice about serving, puts down some fish in front of you. And she says, as she puts it down, this is fish. It's for you to eat. Okay, you eat it. Then, soon afterwards, she comes, she takes the empty plate, says, I'm taking away your plate. Now it's time for soup. She puts the soup down, says, this is soup. Is this necessary? It's ridiculous. The reason why it's ridiculous is that the action speaks for itself. God is in continued communication with us. He communicates with us every second. Whose air are you breathing? Whose gravitational field are you standing on? What prayer does is give us the ability to communicate so that we have real connection, which is what we want more than we want anything else. So just as an example, and there are many prayers in Psukhe de Zimra, what Ashrei is saying is any force in the universe is God's communication to us, and we could find him there, communicate to him, and speak to him from that place. The next section of the prayer service is Shema and its brachot. What's this about? After we finish the Psalms of Praise, which talk about nature and God's hand in nature, and end with his hand in history as it unfolds, the Song of the Sea, we move on to an entirely different phase. We talk about God as being the author of both light and darkness. Not just physical light and darkness, which certainly is true, but every form of light and darkness, every trial, every challenge, every difficulty that we'll call dark, every act of love, every act of growth, everything beautiful that we'll call light, come from one source. We speak about how every day he brings new light to the world. Every day has new inspiration and new possibilities. We speak about our yearning for this, that he bring new light to Eretz Yisrael, or Chadash L'Tzion. We refer to God as holy, so we have some idea of the transcendental source of all of this spiritual light. Then we move into a paragraph that begins with the word Ahavat, Ahavat Olam, or Ahavah Rabbah. There are different versions of the prayer book. But the ideas will speak now about the depth of God's love and actually communicating with us at one point in words. The one time that humans on a group level had verbal communication with God, where we heard words, was when he gave us the Torah, which was an extraordinary act of love. He was breaking his own rules, so to speak, by having this level of communication with people, rather than letting us stretch ourselves out to the maximum to meet with him. And we make requests. We want to live up to it. Okay, we ask for light, spiritual light, so we could learn, teach, observe, understand. 8 different words that describe our desire for connection. This all leads us to the Shema. What's the Shema about? We say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, which we spoke about last time for those of you who were with us. We speak about how Hashem is one with everything. And we go from there into saying that his kingdom is forever and ever. And then we begin talking from our side to him. We take upon ourselves to love Hashem. And as you remember, we said a few moments ago what love is. To make connection with our hearts. Not our heart, with our hearts. With the part of us that's evil, and the part of us that's good, with our animal selves, with our spiritual selves, with our possessions, with our bodies. We take upon ourselves to make connection. In the next paragraph, we talk about God's connection to us through his providence. When we look at Jewish history, we can't help but seeing his providence. One of the primary historians in the 20th century was Arnold Toynbee, who wrote a book called Civilizations, which was about over 2,000 civilizations, which I have to admit gets a bit heavy after a while. But what he noticed is that all the history of all civilizations basically has the same basis. Peoples come together on the basis of external forces and mutual interests, develop, and ultimately, after the development, flowers fall apart and are overtaken by a younger, fresher, more driven civilization. Now, this is true for all of the over 2,000 civilizations that he observed. Doesn't work for the Jews. Doesn't work for us. We have a different pattern. Our pattern seems to be, shockingly, to him but not to us, the pattern that's set forth in the Torah. The more we are ourselves, regardless of what's happening around us, the more we flourish. The more we seek to assimilate, the more quickly we're destroyed. but were never destroyed completely. Of the 2,000 civilizations that he studied, most of them are invisible. You don't find subgoths when you walk around. You don't find Celts. Although in Ireland there are people who are trying to sort of revolve Celtic consciousness, but that's a whole other story. But they're not there. We survive. His conclusion was that we're not a people. Some think he was anti-Semitic, but we'll leave that alone. But in any case, the reason I'm telling you this is that God is committed to us to see that we never disappear. That we never disappear. And because of that, his interactions with us are different than his interactions with any other civilization. After all of this, we've moved from one level of consciousness to another, to still a third. Then we're ready for real prayer. We're ready for real deep communication, which is what the standing prayer, which is called Amidah, or Shmona Esrei, which means 18 because it has 19 brachas. Yes, I realize what I just said. It's called Shmona Esrei because it has 19 brachas. Okay, but we'll talk about that in a moment. We're ready for that. The Shmona Esrei is divided into three sections. The first section is where we bring Hashem into us by noticing in whose world we're living. We see Hashem as the God of the patriarchs, the God who revealed himself to them through his giving, through his force, his concealment, his challenging. Think about their lives. His awesome transcendence. Think about their visions. Okay, he's the same God who creates nature, who creates death, but also creates life. He's the God who's holy, who's above this world and every other level of consciousness we can envision. And then we begin to make our requests. Why are we making requests? So our requests are meant to move us in two directions. One is that we notice what it is that we really want. And the more we're honest about noticing that, the more we'll observe that what we really want will only come from one source. The very first request that we make is for wisdom. You can't go to a store and buy a wisdom. You can't order 25 pounds of wisdom. You can ask God for wisdom because it comes from Him. It's of Him in essence. So we notice that what we want comes only from Him, and that we're totally reliant on Him. The same holds true for the next request, which is for return. We put ourselves in boxes, we make horrific choices, and then we're stuck, we think. But through the process of return, we can open any box. We can get to where we want to be. We ask for forgiveness. You can't buy forgiveness, you can't measure forgiveness. This has to come from God. So these first three requests are spiritual requests because it's what we want the most. They could only be given by God. And recognizing this and asking for it opens us up to Him, and it could cause difference to occur. But our purpose isn't only to get what we've ordered as though it's some sort of mystic Chinese restaurant. But it's also to make a connection that will draw down His love still further as love draws down. But certainly, our primary statement is, I'm connecting. That's what prayer is about. We go on to the next three requests. We ask for salvation. And anybody who could look at the history of the Jewish people or the history of contemporary Israel and not see miracles isn't looking honestly. We ask for healing. And again, anyone who's ever been ill knows where healing comes from. We ask for sustenance, because regardless of how hard we work, you can't eat a dollar, you can't wear a dollar. You could only buy what God will let you trade the dollar for. So we recognize that everything that we gain materially, including the energy to get it, comes from God's love of us. We draw closer. The next set isn't of three, but of four. That's where you have the 19th. is for national redemption. We ask Hashem to see us as one, to draw us back, to bring about redemption. We ask for leadership, which is certainly something that we haven't succeeded in developing ourselves. Look at where we are and look who we're led by. We ask for leadership that comes directly from Him through people who search for Him and want His truth. We ask for wickedness to be destroyed, and this is the blessing that was added later. All of the other blessings were formulated by the men of the Great Assembly, a group of people who, at the beginning of the Second Temple period, composed the prayer book. This one was added much later because of the Christian persecutions. We ask for the destruction of evil, because in a world in which there's evil, either in us or outside of us, goodness can't flourish. We end this section by asking that we have a relationship to people who are truly pious, who are exemplary, who are models, and that Hashem preserve them because we need good. That ends the section concerning return on a national level. Our last requests are for Yerushalayim, for Mashiach, and then, of course, the great catch-all, where we ask for whatever we want. The idea being that when Mashiach comes, which is definitely part of our belief system, which we'll talk about in another class, what happens that makes it different than the world as it is now is who's running the show. When Mashiach comes, the world will be under God's rule. When you think of what's wrong with the world today, look around you, think, read a paper. Is it perfect? Are we doing a hugely marvelous job? Is that what you would say to somebody in Darfur? What's wrong with the world is one thing. We're not God conscious. Could a person who's God conscious possibly allow the world to look like this? Would there be violence? Would there be hatred? Would there be war if people were God conscious? I'll just give you two facts that that to me say a great deal. There's starvation in the world, as everybody knows, but you know, there's enough food. It just happens that a particular country uses close to a third of the world's gross natural produce, but there's enough food. But to me, what's even worse than that is that India exports rice. If any of you have ever been to India, then you'll know that to walk into a hotel, sometimes you have to walk over people who spend their entire lifetime in the street. They're born in the street, and they die in the street. And between those two moments, there's never a roof over their head. This isn't a country that exports food. What's missing is God awareness. And until Mashiach comes, we're going to still be saying it's missing. This is why we want Mashiach. And the catch-all bracha, Shema Koleinu. We want to be heard. We want connection. We want tangible connection. We want to pour ourselves out to God and confess to Him our vulnerability and our mortality, and to ask Him to make His closeness more observable. The prayer service ends with blessings for Thanksgiving as a formal end. What's that about? What that's about is, again, let's go back to my dining room, my daughter putting the soup in front of you. This is soup. Now, she doesn't have to say that because it's apparent to you. You know what it is. At the end of the meal, if you're a mannerly person, which I'm sure you all are, you'll thank me for hosting you. The reason you'll do that is that you'll realize that you had a meal and it came from somewhere. Everything we experience, especially our own consciousness and awareness, comes from God. This is why in the prayers for Thanksgiving, we don't say, oh, thank you for the soup. The soup! That's the least of it. We thank our God for consciousness. Modim anachdolach shatah Hashem Elokeinu, that you're the giver, the one who is, who relates to us every generation. We thank Him for our souls. Another question came in. It was asked, why is our communion with God so structured instead of giving us more opportunity for self-expression? This is a good question. There's a good reason for this. But before I tell you the reason, before I answer your question, okay, let's be honest with that. I want to tell you that self-created prayers are very important, in addition to the formal prayers that I'm discussing. The Rambam himself says the way to find a path in love of God is through hitbonenut, is through thinking deeply about Him. So there's a place for looking at the world and looking at yourself and other people. In all three ways that we see things, the length, the breadth, the depth, meaning, seeing how encompassing things are, seeing how inclusive things are, seeing how profound things are, length, breadth, depth. Talking about our lives to God as we would to a friend. Master of the world, I don't know what to say. I'm afraid of half the people I meet. I'm afraid of rejection. I'm afraid of pain. I'm afraid of vulnerability. Talking to Him. But there's a limitation on self-composed prayers, and now I'll answer your question. When the men of the Great Assembly got together to compose the prayer book, it was for a reason. The reason was that they observed that after 70 years in exile, which isn't all that long, but after 70 years in exile, the Jews lost their language. They weren't speaking the Holy Tongue any longer. They were speaking Aramaic, which was the language of Babylon. Why is that important? Surely God understands every language. The reason why that's important is that the language you speak reflects how you think, what your mentality is. In Arabic, there are many words for camel. In English, there aren't. In English, there are many words for snow and rain, precipitation, storm. In Arabic, there aren't. We spoke Babylonian for the same reason the Jews who came from Europe spoke English in just one generation. We were thinking Babylonian. Part of the purpose of making a set prayer book isn't just to give expression to who we are, but to form who we could be. Meaning we're meant to feel a certain amount of discomfort with the prayer book. We have to grow into it. As I mentioned before, our first request is for enlightenment, for knowing. If you ask most people, what do you really want? They'll say, I want a good car. I want more money. I want a boyfriend. I want to get married. Whatever it is that I want. But very few of us think deeply enough to say what I really, really want is consciousness, because without that, whatever I have has no value. So they created prayers for us to grow into. And through saying them in an almost mantra-like fashion, three times a day, we move ourselves towards where the prayers could take us. The prayers we could compose ourselves are limited by one factor, and that factor is us. So because of this, we view the prayers of the prayer book to have superior possibilities, but we certainly need self-composed prayers as well. After we finish all of this, we said thank you, we go back to requesting something. We go back to requests and we ask for peace. The reason why this request isn't made together with all of the other requests, and why it's so ungraceful after you say thank you to go request something else. It's like these old vaudeville shows where after the act is finished, one of the actors would go up and have to be pulled off the stage with a cane. The reason is that without peace, nothing has a place to be. What peace means by definition is putting everything in its place like in a basket. So it's only after we've made our request that we could ask for peace in a meaningful way. Peace is the last thing we asked for. However, there's a meditation that was added on by the sages, which isn't a blessing and isn't really formally part of the Shemona Esrei. Some of you may have seen it. It begins with the words, Elokai Netzor. My God, guard my mouth from evil. Guard my tongue from evil. Okay, we ask Hashem to make it that we have enough consciousness that we could watch what we say, because we could destroy everything He gives us through bad speech. Through being unwilling to see positivity, through being unwilling to see the beauty in others, through being unwilling to see His communications, by disparaging everything, we could destroy everything He gives us. We ask for humility, because when we're self-centered, we see nothing except ourselves. Okay, we ask him to give us these things for the sake of his name, for the sake of his Torah, and by asking this, we rise above self. And here, at the very end, there's a second place where we could continue and speak to God in our own words. You could stay there in prayer as long as you want. And the function there is to be able to say, and here I am, Hashem, and I've praised you, and I've thanked you, and I've asked for peace, but this is who I am. The prayer concludes by our stepping back and asking Hashem to again make peace above, below, with us, and to rebuild the temple where we'll have the higher consciousness that will let us have prayers on every level, including the sacrificial offerings. So if somebody says, why is it worth it? Why is it worth it? He says, it's worth to pray to God. It's worth it because what we want more than anything we'll ever want is connection. What we want more than anything with the world is to uplift it and to have meaning. Prayer is the key to connection and meaning. Is it worth praying to anything else? Of course not. Of course not. It's self-understood. People oftentimes, in virtually all societies, have fallen into the terrible trap of superstition. How many of you out there have a red string? Sure, more than one. There's a lot of poo-poo-poo, the ayin hara. Why do we go there? So the reason why we go there takes us back to what we said at the beginning, that prayer isn't. It's not a way of trying to control events. Quite the opposite. Prayer is an acknowledgement of the fact that God controls events. But we're very hesitant to let go. So we create magic that we see doesn't do anything, but we hold on to it anyway. If I wear a red string, then for sure everything is going to be great. It's better than saying if I control my life, everything will be great. If I turn to God, everything will be great. In fact, if you turn to God, everything is great already. I'll conclude with this. Be together again next.